The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this seven-day session here in August 2016 at Hidden Valley Zen Center. Our 1 7-day session a year at this point, although we do have a 5-day session in February. And perhaps in the next few years we'll be adding more of the longer sessions. In the meantime, we have many of the little weekend sessions, which seem to be perfect for people who have regular jobs and can't get off for more than a week or two from their work in a year. I'd like to share with you today an interesting source, and that is Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, of course, is pretty much a household word. I'm not sure there's any of you here in the Zendu who have not ever heard his name. He actually was an interesting person. He didn't really fit in as a kid, nor as an adult either, and yet he was able to discern the answers to some profound questions about the nature of science. And as you heard yesterday, he didn't go at his scientific explorations through his head, through thinking. He didn't think his way to the answers. Instead, he would sit down in a place that was comfortable enough, but where he could have a kind of an inner space, and he would just go into a sort of a soft focus, not thinking about anything in particular. And these answers, these profound answers, would bubble up for him. And he was also quite wise. A human being is a part of the whole that we call the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical illusion of his consciousness. When Kapha Roshi would quote him, he would say an optical delusion of his consciousness. This illusion is a prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for only the few people nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living beings and all of nature. Let's go through that one more time. A human being is a part of the whole that we call the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical illusion of his consciousness. This illusion is a prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for only the few people nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living beings and all of nature. And we have Dogen, considered to be the founder of the Soto sect of Buddhism, of Zen Buddhism, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. To be enlightened by the 10,000 things is to remove the barrier between self and other. To remove the barrier between self and other. Quite often, the first hint, let's say, of an awakening comes with a sudden sense that we are one with everything. And that is one aspect of truth. It's not we can't consider it an awakening yet, although it is a tremendous experience for most people. But it's on the way. Due to our conditioning, we develop a self-image. And that self-image is usually more and more restricted the older we get. We have experiences that cause us fear and anxiety. We want very much to belong. And when there's any indication that we might be in danger of losing that belonging, it gets to be rather frightening. And so we begin to have an investment in maintaining and defending this self-image. When we feel angry, when we feel embarrassed, these are concrete expressions of an attempt to maintain that self-image. It is that self-image that keeps us prisoner. Just as Einstein was saying, a human being is part of a whole that we call the universe, a part limited in time and space, and yet we are beyond that as well. We assume that we're limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical illusion of his consciousness. This illusion is a prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for only the few people nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from the prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living beings and all of life, really. As we are able to go deeper and deeper in our practice, and this self-image begins to wear thin, and we begin to find ourselves able to be more responsive in clear and compassionate ways to what otherwise might be thought of as difficult situations. Our practice, of course, involves primarily coming to awakening, but the purpose in coming to awakening is to be able to manifest that awakening in everything we do or say or think. And part of that process involves increasingly letting go of this self-image, or certainly of the need to defend and maintain it, because it gets us into trouble. It causes people to murder each other. It causes wars. And short of that, it causes untold grief and ruptured relationships and unease among people and disharmony in life. You know the story of Shiro Munan, the eminent monk who was actually a deeply realized Zen master, who in middle age was accused of fathering a baby by an unwed young woman in the village that he was living in Japan. A situation that we can't really comprehend the direness of, in terms of the family and theoretically in terms of Shiro Munan as well. And in fact, after he received that baby, which the grandparents brought to him in anger and frustration and mortal embarrassment, he took great care of this child, this infant, at great cost to himself. The village scorned him. In those days, it's not true now, but in those days, monks and priests in Japan were celibate. Since the Meiji Restoration changed things around and the Buddhist establishment was forced into some changes in the relationship to government, monks are no longer considered non-secular. They are subject to the draft, they're subject to taxes, etc., etc. Not so different from how it is actually in a certain way in the United States, although we have a little bit of more leeway in terms of being subject to the draft. For one thing, there's no draft at the moment, but when there was, we could get a deferment, or not a deferment, we could be off the rolls if we had a religious calling. The same goes for paying taxes. If you live in poverty in a community, in a religious community, and you sign a form attesting to that, you are no longer liable for income tax in the United States, but it's a permanent thing. And it carries penalties if it's not true and accurate. So Shiro Monan had a very difficult time simply surviving, and here he had this infant that he had to take care of as well. In an era before they had disposable diapers, formula, and all the other conveniences that new families have for their infants these days. You remember that when the baby was presented to him, he didn't argue back about it. He didn't need to. He didn't feel a need to defend himself. This is a profound and deep level of awakening. This is what I hope each one of you here in the Zendo, and more than each one of you here in the Zendo, will one day realize and be able to live. It is an incredible amount of freedom not to have to react in anger, not to have to defend some kind of mythical self-image. And of course, at the end of the year, when the grandparents came to get the baby back again in deep embarrassment because the mother finally confessed who the father was, again, he felt no need to comment other than a very humble response. Oh, I see. It seems to be this way, doesn't it? How many of us can truly respond like that? This is a great Zen master modeling what is possible for every human being. He has stepped out of the prison of the self-image. All of us have come to practice because of some sixth sense that such a thing might be possible. Perhaps not specifically as that, but we all have a sense that there's something beyond. As Kapil Rishi would say, business as usual. And there is. It takes faith, determination, and perplexity to reach that deep awareness, a deep enough awareness to see that face before our parents were born, to know that mu intimately, to hear that sound of the one hand. And each of us has the capacity to do that. It is a challenge because we are working against all of our conditioning. And it's not always a pleasant experience to suddenly become aware of where we've been responding, or rather reacting, really, out of that self-image instead of out of the clarity that we may have in part gained through our practice. It's hard work, but it's bodhisattva work. Because as you saw in that shikishi that was standing up when you came into the dining hall today, when I change, the world changes. When I change, the world changes. Sometimes these major shifts in attitude come shortly before a person is dying, shortly before they do actually die, the last 2 or 3 days often. There's a story, actually there are many stories. It's a book about this kind of thing that can happen as people die. And one story stands out. It's about a man who was quite nasty all his life. And he was dying young, actually. Don't recall what he was dying of. In fact, I'm not sure it was mentioned. But he was dying, and he was angry, and he was bitter, just as he had been in life before he got sick. And suddenly, 24 hours before he actually died, something shifted in him, and he became quite different. Loving, caring, concerned with other people's well-being, no longer concerned with his own ideas about himself, no longer any need to defend himself against an angry world. He thought it was an angry world when it was actually that he himself was angry. It was a wonderful thing, I'm sure, for his family to witness and experience. For one thing, when we can die like that, what happens next in our karmic process is going to be considerably more positive than what could have happened had we died in a furious, bitter mind state. And I think about my own grandmother, who at 95, let's see, she was the one that died at 93, I think, at 93 years of age. And she's always been rather dogmatic. In fact, I remember my brother and I were sent to live with our grandparents for about a year after we moved back from Canada, while my parents built a house in Cleveland Heights. And one day my grandmother and I were driving up to Cleveland Heights from Youngstown. In those days, before interstate highways, took an hour and a half. And I remember arguing the entire way with her, in good fun, to be sure. There was a family dictum in that part of the family that all Catholics were evil. And this came out of one solitary experience wherein a cousin of my grandfather had married a Catholic boy, and after 3 kids, he'd abandoned the family. Of course, one doesn't know the actual details other than the fact, of course, that it's coming from his side of the family, my grandfather's side of the family. And therefore, of course, all Catholics are evil, right? Goes without saying. This is unfortunately, although it's a caricature of how people can think, it's not so far from how most of us think about certain kinds of things, and it's important to really become aware of that. Anyway, so grandmother and I were arguing the entire way for the hour and a half about whether all Catholics were evil. And I knew I'd won when she said, "I don't want to talk about it anymore." That's usually how she indicated she lost the argument. At any rate, she was, as I say, pretty dogmatic, and continued to be so through her long life. And every time I would see her as she got older, even in her 70s, and certainly later on as well, she would say, "I'm ready to meet my maker." And I would think to myself, "No, you're not, grandmother." And finally, I learned from my aunt and uncle. My uncle was her youngest child, her only son. And by that time, she was living in a retirement home. In fact, I think she progressed from the independent living to some version of caretaking, being cared for. And the retirement home called my uncle and said, "You have any idea what's going on with your mother? She's been crying all day and all night yesterday. What's going on?" So my aunt and uncle went up to visit her, and my take on it is that she began to see more clearly, as is said before we die, we see more clearly what we have done in our life and how we have done it. And she had a great deal of regret for having behaved that way. She wasn't nasty in my experience, but she was very strong-willed. And after that, she was a changed human being. And I thought, now you can meet your maker, grandmother. Now you've done the work. Now you've let go. Now you can go. And 6 months later, she died. We go through that process of seeing more clearly our behavior as we go deeper in our practice. And this is often what sends people running away from the zendo and away from practice, because it's not fun. When we suddenly realize that we had a tone of voice, for example, when we said something that was accusatory or in anger, and we didn't think we were angry. We didn't feel like we were accusing, but at some level, perhaps subconscious, we were. And yet, in order to become free of our conditioning, we have to see where it's had its impact. Otherwise, we're still caught. Otherwise, we still act out, even if we don't recognize we're acting out, because it's so subconscious. So we're called upon to be quite brave as we go about our practice, willing to see humbly, willing to become humble, willing not to have to demand an environment in order to be comfortable. All of us, at some level, have been there, done that, and probably are being there, doing that. We like certain things. We don't like certain things. We often feel that we have to have a certain environment in order to be able to function easily, able to get enough sleep, for example. I can remember at Sogenji, the dogs barking all night. And when you're only getting 4 hours of sleep at night, that's a little bit of a challenge. No earplugs. And I want to share something that happened at Sogenji. Some of you know this already. Not all of you do. There was a monk. All of us were called monks, whether we were ordained or not, at Sogenji, because we were all doing the same training, whether or not we wore robes. There was a man from Europe who at one point told me that he came to Japan to take up Zen because he was afraid he would be killed if he stayed in France. And he came from a family with a brutal father, lived mostly on the streets, and was a very angry person inside, in a way. He tried. There were long periods of time when he was able to be harmonious and actually quite nice with people. And then when pressure built up, and it was often when a sesshin was starting, another part of him emerged, a very vicious part, very sadistic part. And he would start to act out, and he usually focused on one person or another to do that with or against. And I was Jishariyo at the time. The Jishariyo is tasked, among other things, with making sure people follow the rules of the temple. And in the winter, the keisaku is used at Sogenji, four strikes on each shoulder. Snap, 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 snap. That's because the robes are thick, and it's assumed that you're wearing a fair amount of clothing underneath, although theoretically it's only three robes allowed. And as sesshin was beginning, he carried the keisaku. By the way, he's no longer allowed to carry keisaku, nor has he been allowed to for a long time since. And there was one person he was focusing on negatively, and he struck that person five times, and on the bone, clearly on purpose. And I looked over in that direction to let him know that it was seen, was recognized. And when Chisan came in at the kinhin that immediately followed that period, I said, what'll I do? This is what happened. And she said, tell the Roshi in Sanzen. But by the time I got to my Sanzen, he had already been to his, and Chisan had told the Roshi. And the Roshi really, I don't know exactly what he did, but definitely he lit into him, because this was not the first time this guy had done this kind of thing. He periodically would get sent back to France for misbehaving. But from then on, he targeted me. And in fact, I was told that the Roshi had ordered that I'd be escorted to and from the Zendo by two big guys. To get on this guy's wrong side was not something anyone ever wanted to do, because he could be, as I said, quite sadistic. And one time I was getting ready to go in town on an errand, and I was in the garage getting my bicycle ready. And it was a time when we were building the guest house. He had gone to the kura, the place where the tools were kept, because he was in charge of felling trees. Trees were used, actually they were sent to a sawmill and turned into lumber, and that's what was used to build that guest house. Trees from the mountain side that Sogenji owned. And the guest house was quite a ways up the hill from the garage. The kura was before the garage. He got a chainsaw out of the garage and started it and went right next to me with the chain running literally 2 inches away from my leg. Things like that were happening. Later, I was the guest housekeeper. The guest housekeeper lives in a room that has no locked doors. It's just shoji, and although some shoji are locked in Japan, these were not. Nor were the doors to the guest house locked. And the Roshi went away to Europe along with Chisan, and I felt somebody looking at me, boring into me with a very negative gaze, turned, and it was this guy. So I asked the administrative monk who was in charge then, a Japanese man, to please send somebody, one of the big guys who was not afraid of this guy, to live in the guest house while Roshi was in Europe. And he did. He understood. So this kind of thing went on. Little subtle negative things and not so subtle negative things. And I was just doing my best to stay out of his way and not to do anything that would be particularly inflammatory to him. And then, a few months before I was scheduled to return to the United States, I thought, okay, I'm not going to be here for a full training period at Sogenji, therefore I will not be getting a position at the Kotai, the change of positions. And so we go into the Kohojo for it's called Sosari, a very formal tea, in which we bow our heads all the way to the ground, and the Roshi announces the positions for the next year, the next training period, who the Jisharya will be, who the assistant Jisharya will be, and in this case there were three of us, because there were enough people at Sogenji by then that needed more people, and who would be the people who headed the Zendo, ran the Jikijutsu position when the Roshi, who was himself Jikijutsu, was off doing Sanzen or whatever. And I was shocked to hear my name listed first as the first Jishario. And that means I was in charge of the other two people that were my assistants. And the next person was this man. And the person after that was a woman, actually she was an American woman, who was raised without any limits on her behavior, and she acted as if there were no limits on her behavior at Sogenji too. She was a challenge. And I knew the instant that announcement was made that I was going to have to make a move in a positive direction to this man. Otherwise, it was not going to work. As the head person in the Jishario team, I would take the hit. And he had every ability in the book to make it really bad for me. He could do, because the men, the male version of the team, the Jishario team, is usually a guy and a woman at Sogenji, because the women take care of the women and the guys take care of the guys. And the man, who is the Jishario part of the team, also takes care of the altar and the Zendo and some other things like that. And so as I'm taking a tray full of cups, because then after that announcement we have tea, back to the kitchen, I pass him in a narrow corridor, and I say to him, and I meant it, and I had to mean it, because it wouldn't have worked if I didn't. I said, I'm sorry for what's happened between us in the past. And I honestly felt regret, even though somebody looking on the outside would say, none of it was my fault. I understood the six patriarchs saying, if others are to blame, I alone am to blame. In relationships, it's always two to tango, at least. There's nobody who's a true innocent in a relationship. When we look at the karmic details, and I understood that at some level, just however I was inflaming him. And I wanted to tell him I was sorry for whatever it was, because I was. And to my amazement, he said, I am too. And although the next several months before I returned to the States, after living there for some years, were not a bed of roses, they did have a few thorns here and there, but they certainly didn't have the thorns they would have had I not been able to say that. That shikishi at the dining room table is absolutely right on. When I change, the world changes. When we are able to step out of the box of our conditioning, out of the box of needing to uphold, maintain, and defend a self-image that's nothing but a false story, a set of false assumptions about ourselves that we developed as a result of how we have experienced the world. And then, as part of that, how we experience the world influences the world in treating us in certain ways. And most people fail to understand that. We look and we think, this person is to blame because they're being nasty or whatever. Something outside us. But there's always something inside us that's triggering that. This is all part of what Tore Enji called the long maturation. This is the nitty-gritty work of coming to awakening and moving more and more fully into enlightened activity. We've all heard the emphasis on how glorious a Kensho can be. And for a long time, particularly earlier in Zen in America, everybody sort of thought that was the goal and that was the end of it. Even Kepler Roshi, when he went to Japan to train in Zen, his intention was to get Kensho and run back to the United States. Thankfully, he didn't. He stayed another many, many years. 13 years, I believe it was, he was training in Japan. Going to every possible sesshin, first in a couple of different monasteries, and then when he got malnutrition, living out in Kamakura and teaching English, so that enabled him to buy food he wouldn't have been able to get at the monastery. This path that we are on is an incredible, profoundly liberating path. But in reaching that level of liberation, there's a lot of challenging experiences we're going to have to navigate in a way that we can let them go. Straightforward bravery is what Hakuin said so often to his monks. You must have straightforward bravery. But as you continue to deepen your practice, if you truly work on it, you will find that it is so incredibly worth it. So I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.